Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig.
Yeah, a little bit of weekly sunshine in a world of food, wine, and travel. We look forward to talking to you. We hope you look forward to listening to us.
Yes, I'm sure they all do. And let's start off with a bit of very current hot news concerning... Go ahead.
Concerning a very special combination of an Italian menu and an exciting new Italian wine that's taking place at Capitol Grills across the country for the next 6 weeks, brought to our attention by a good old friend who introduced himself anyway in this announcement.
If you're a regular visitor to On the Menu's homepage, then you know that there's a section called OTM News, and there are headlines on the homepage about events that are taking place that we think will be of interest. And Chef Donato Coluccio from the Capitol Grill in Pittsburgh, who's on the line with us now, brought this to our attention just yesterday, and we said, well, we've got to put it up as news, but we've got to capture Donato telling us a little bit more about what this is about. So off you go, Donato.
Thank you, and good afternoon.
Hi, Donato.
Peter and Ann, thank you.
Anyhow,
we're doing a special event for the next 6 weeks. It starts February 23rd through April the 5th, and we are going to be doing a dinner. It's a five-course dinner tasting menu, and this is the American debut of Castello Banfi Balnero Proprietors Reserve. It's a Sangiovese di Montalcino, and we will be the only facility, us and the other Capitol Grills across the nation, will be the only people to have this wine right now for the next 6 weeks. So we're going to roll it out with this special menu, and it's a really nice bottle of wine. So
that means Black Beauty, I heard you saying.
Black Beauty.
Yeah, we're all puzzled by how it's spelled with a capital O on the end, and I'm waiting for Castello Banfi to give me the answer to that one. The menu is Italian in inspiration, Donato, like you are yourself?
Yes, it is. And it's going to be a nice one, too.
So
you've got some filet on there, then opposite that you get a choice of pesce spada. We can't call it swordfish.
Swordfish.
Because we're doing it, in Italian.
Spada.
I'm sorry, pesce spada.
and then we've got some macaroni, which a lot of people would call lasagna.
Correct, and then we have the gelato, we have a sorbetto, and we have an insalata with finocchio.
We're really Italian today.
Yeah, we are. But it's a nice menu. You get the five courses, and it's for $49, and then the wine goes for $89 a bottle, which normally this wine would probably go for around $200 a bottle.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, what, Donato, how does it work? People can make a reservation to have this menu. The whole restaurant doesn't have it. Any individual table can just say, I want this.
Any individual table can come in. Any individual person at a table can also come in and order this whenever they would like for lunch or dinner. And they can also order bits and pieces of the menu. For instance, if somebody just wanted to have the lemon basil sorbet, or if somebody just wanted to have the swordfish roasted in parchment paper, we can do that as well. But what we want to do is to give you the real experience. Obviously, you get the courses. It's a nice value for a dollar, and you get the wine with that. And it all matches perfectly, and you can make a night out just on this menu and having this stuff.
Oh, I'm sure you can.
I wonder how it tastes. I'm dying to taste this wine.
Well, we just sampled 2004 Brunello, just released, in fact, pre-release, from the same supplier, and it was delicious. So I'm sure this is going to be delicious too.
And we've been at Banfi.
We went by.
It's huge.
In fact, we stopped to ask directions. It's a rather fascinating place because it was built in like 1910 by Americans. Now, they were Americans of Italian ancestry,
right,
but they were Americans, and they've owned Castello Banfi since the beginning. And it's truly a wonderful property and a very big one too. But it seems like that. Always being innovative, and they're trying to establish a new price point and a new style of wine from the Toscana region around Montalcino. So I can't wait to taste it. I think it's going to be great, and we'll be in to see you next week. Now, before we go,
let's go over the numbers.
Yep. I think it's not on the Capitol Grill website that I saw, so people are going to need a telephone number for you, and they can get telephone numbers across the country from the Capitol Grill website.
Come to Capitol Grill website, and we actually are sending invitations out to anybody that's part of our newsletter that signed up for that on our website, and wine locker holders and other people that are on our mailing list. So they'll get invitations handwritten, and then the phone number for the Capitol Grills across the country, it's just on the CapitolGrill.com website, and our phone number here at this store is 412-338-9100, and we do offer free valet parking after 5 o'clock during all week long, including the weekends.
Yeah, Capital Grill has an E, right?
Yeah, Capital Grill has an E on the end
because
it's pretending to be old-fashioned and clubby and British.
That's it. That's right. Capital Grill, C-A-P-I-T-A-L.
And we love it.
I got to tell you, Donato Coluccio and the general manager there set a mean table, and as a result of that, they're busy. No recession at the Capital Grill, Pittsburgh. Donato, thanks a lot for bringing this to our attention. We'll look forward to enjoying it with you ourselves.
Thank you, and I look forward to having you and all your listeners have a safe and prosperous week.
Thanks, Donato.
Thank you, Ann.
We'll see you when we come.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, bye. Next up is, first of all, I never knew the word Trackelmans, I did look it up, and I think we talk about it on this interview, but I'll tell you, the product that we're going to be talking about is ooh so scrumptious.
So let's let it speak for itself.
Well, we are totally in love with the new product, and we have the producer of the product on the line, T.R. Durham. And his business is actually called Trackelmans and Smokery, and it's located in all places, Ann Arbor, Michigan. Welcome, T.R.
Thank you very much, Ann.
We're going to be talking about your business, but we're also going to be talking about this interesting cookbook, the Smoked Seafood Cookbook, Easy Innovative Recipes from America's Best Fish Smokery.
Let's get things sorted out first.
I mean, first of all, I want to say I believe that since we tasted it, that it's America's best smokery.
I agree, but it's sort of like, it's really interesting because if you remember, Shakespeare had a sea coast in Bohemia, which is in the middle of Europe. It's now in Czechoslovakia. And the last I heard, Ann Arbor was not on any large body of water.
Seawater.
So how come, T.R.?
The T.R. started in Maine, right?
Oh, okay. Yeah, but
how come we're in Ann Arbor instead of Maine or Massachusetts? Where we started out, actually.
And where do you catch all the salmon in the Ann Arbor River?
Well, you know, if I had to rely on any fish that I caught here, we would have been out of business a long time ago.
So what's the combination? You buy your raw materials from?
Well, we get some of our salmon from the Canadian Bay of Fundy, but over the last 3 years, we've actually been getting most of our salmon, particularly for the cold smoked salmon that you tried, from Scotland and some from Ireland. And it usually gets here within, say, 2 or 3 days out of the water, and it's just been an absolutely superb starting place for our products.
Well, we have to jump back further. I mean, you started out your working career as a school teacher.
That's correct, yep.
Now, there's something's missing in this transition. Could you just explain how you went from that, from being a school teacher in Maine to being a smoker in Ann Arbor, Michigan?
Well, I think some of it is just, sort of jumping from one kind of interest that was parallel with some others after a time. I loved the teaching for a long time, but always had fantasy, often shared with some of my colleagues, of starting something like a bar or small restaurant or some kind of barbecue place or brewery. And I think at one point I just started doing this as a backyard basement hobby after spending some time in Ireland and Scotland. And after a sabbatical, it was clear that my preference would be to just keep doing this year-round rather than just doing it for the holidays.
Can I quote you here? This is a totally different cookbook. I am a recovering academic, having spent 25 years presenting ideas to the eager young minds of America before deciding that rubbing dry salt cure on fish might be better suited to my temperament and possibly more productive.
It has been more productive, although that was written after teaching, say, during the Reagan years, and since I was teaching environmental studies and things like business ethics and that was not the most hospitable environment, I would say.
Now, back to the salmon, because mm-hmm. Anne and I were talking. She was telling me that in your previous conversation, she had picked up the fact that quite a lot of your raw material fish is actually farmed.
Oh, yes. We use a little bit of the wild Pacific salmon when it's in good condition and affordable, and that's usually during the summer, but it's a very limited window. And in fact, for most of our cold-smoked salmons, in any event, I think the Atlantic salmon is vastly superior just because of the way the oil and fat is distributed throughout the flesh rather than being sort of subcutaneous with the Pacific wild salmons. And I think that's been the big factor just in determining what kind of salmon we use. And the only way you can get Atlantic salmon on a reliable, high-quality basis is from farms. The important thing, I think, for many people to realize is that farming practices have been transformed in the last, say, 8 to 10 years. There's still a huge range of quality in farming operations, but in Ireland and the Shetlands and Scotland and Norway in particular, and in the Bay of Fundy, in some operations, the feed, the location, the cleaning practices, the harvesting practices, everything have just been dramatically changed from what was sort of the, routine protocols maybe 10 years ago.
Now, you also have, in all of those areas you mentioned, you also have two other things going. The farmers also have two other things going for them. Water that's very deep and water that's very tidal, so there's a significant amount of change in the water that occurs naturally as well.
Exactly. In the Bay of Fundy, of course, they have 30 to 40 foot tides, and it's extremely cold water, even in the summer. So you have a lot of highly oxygenated water. You don't have the ecological impact that a lot of people...
Yeah, see, that's why it's not politically correct anymore in the sustainable community, is the ecological impact, right?
That has been one of the criticisms, but, there are more places now in Scotland and in the Shetlands and Ireland where they're actually doing certified organic salmon, and they also have a separate category of sustainable salmons that are monitored, audited very closely by groups like Natureland out of Germany and the UK Soil Conservancy for feed and things like that. So, and the location of the pens that where the salmon are farmed have been changed from, say, more static settings like estuaries and locks into more deep sea current locations. And the density of the salmon in the pens has been dropped very dramatically.
Okay, that's a good thing.
Most of the problems that people have rightly associated with many of the farming operations, I would say 10 to 12 years ago, have been not universally and uniformly, but in many cases addressed very successfully. I think there's still ongoing efforts, but you can actually see it in the quality of the salmon that we get now.
See, yeah, criticism will be turned around.
Well, we're buying Atlantic salmon, farmed Atlantic salmon from our chosen seafood supplier all the time, and
I still prefer Copper River salmon.
It's a very satisfactory product.
I agree, especially for fresh salmon that you're going to cook or roast, or the Copper River Kings, and I actually like the sockeye a great deal.
Yeah, we do too.
Distinctive flavor, but for the coal smoke products in particular, because of the difference in the way the oils are distributed, those fish don't make it as good a product in terms of the texture and the mouthfeel.
I see.
They can be very nicely flavored, but I've tried here for, I don't know, maybe 5 or 8 years come up with a satisfactory result, or one that even comes close to what we do with Atlantic salmon, and just, this is all in the judgment of our customers, doesn't come close. So in the end, we stick primarily with the Atlantic salmon for those.
Well, you have a great texture in yours. I mean, it's wonderful because it can become so icky. Tell us, you've mentioned cold smoking a number of times. Can you briefly explain the difference between hot and cold? Well, I mean, they're obvious,
sure.
I guess.
Yeah, glad to. The cold smoking is, the cured salmon is smoked at basically a room temperature of, say, 70 degrees or below for a period of time that can be 12 to 18 to more hours. It doesn't cook the salmon. The salmon is cured with salt and maybe some sugar, which changes the structure of the protein so that it's a more resilient, pliable kind of fish, and then it gets air-dried as it gets smoked. Hot smoking is actually a more complicated process in that usually the fish is brine-cured rather than dry-cured, which is what we do with the coal smoke product. It's brine-cured, then it's Then it's coal smoked for a while, and then you step the temperature up to a low cooking temperature for a while, and then you set it up to about 180 to 190 degrees so that it ends up being cooked and it has a, you know, a flaky, chunky kind of texture.
Ah, so that's the difference. So that's the difference. Okay. Now, I have to ask one more question, and then we should also let you talk a little bit about your cookbook. But why do you think yours is so good? I mean, it came up in conversation that somebody said this is the best smoked salmon they've ever tasted. I can't remember one that I liked near as well in my own taste memory. So what makes yours so good?
Well, that's great to hear. It's the kind of comments that really keep us in business, I think, and provides a lot of the psychic income that we have. I think there are two things. One is we really, are very careful about sourcing the salmon and using salmon only when it really comes in top quality. And the second thing that we do that I don't think anybody else really does to the same extent is we do a hand-rub dry cure. Rather than a brining cure. The brining cure is the commercial curing method of choice because it's quick, it's very predictable, it gets the legally required amount of salt into the flesh very quickly, and in this business, like a lot of others, time is money, and so their turnaround time is very short. Our cure, we generally cure for 36 to 48, and for our seasoned cures, up to 72 hours or more, refrigerated after the hand-rub dry cure. And I think, in the end, that tends to capture the flavor of the salmon and develops a texture that is very hard to get with brine curing. Beyond that, I don't know, but I think those are the decisive things.
The mouth feels just wonderful.
Yeah, I think what happens is you care.
Well, we have to care. We're a very small business, and we're really only as good as our next batch, so we have to stay on top of it constantly. And we also have a lot of customers who've been with us, for mail order customers and now retail customers, who have been incredibly loyal and supportive over the last, say, 12 to 15 years, so we have to care about them, too. So it translates into a lot of attention to the product quality. And when we have stuff that doesn't come out right, we just throw it out. We don't push it on.
Okay, so you must have a website, because we now have people's mouth watering for some of this stuff. So
right.
before we go off onto another subject, what's your website, T.R.?
The website is just www.tracklements.com.
Yeah, I think you better spell that.
I was just about to. Yeah, Trackelments, TRACKLEMENTS.
Okay.
And so there's an R after the T. A lot of people think of it as tacklements, and they think it might have to do with
fishing
lures and lines and poles, but that's not. Yeah.
Since you brought it up, you have a section where you explain Trackelments. We were talking about it before. It's a bit of whimsy, isn't it?
Whimsy?
Yeah.
On our part?
Yes.
I would say so, yeah. it's actually a word that I learned about reading Dorothy Hartley and just fell in love with the kind of the sound and the look of it. And originally, when we started this business in Massachusetts, I had an idea that we might expand into mustards and chutneys and things like that. And in addition to the salmon and other smoked fish, so I wanted something that was a little more encompassing than, say, the fish smokehouse.
Yeah.
So, and actually now we're starting to, I have some very good friends here in Ann Arbor who are interested in doing some mustards and chutneys and relishes, and I'm hoping that, say, within the next year we might have a very nice line
of
these that are made by a couple people who have been making them, first at their mother's side in India and now on a regular basis on their own here in Ann Arbor. So we'll see how that goes.
And in the meantime, there's a wonderful cookbook that goes along with this, which is the way we were first introduced.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called, sweetheart?
The Smoked Seafood Cookbook. Easy, innovative recipes from America's best fish smokery. And the reason you wrote this, TR, is because everybody kept saying, what can we do besides plop this on a bagel?
Well, I think that's that was certainly prepared the ground for this, because with more and more questions like that, and especially, having moved to Ann Arbor and gone into retail more than wholesale and mail order, We had so many customers coming in with those questions, or in many cases offering their own suggestions about some things they had tried and liked and they wanted to pass on. And so over a 10-year period, we collected a large number of recipes or sort of suggested recipes or sketched out recipes. And then we started, my wife in particular, started cooking out of a lot of more ethnic and national cuisines, you know, represented by different cookbooks. And then we would try adding different kinds of smoked fish, either the salmon or the haddock in particular, or the mackerel, the trout, to some of these things. And again, over time, she came up with a number of very excellent recipes.
You've got chili with smoked fish.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that because, you know, especially with 12 inches of snow on the ground here now and 10-degree temperatures, it's sort of a surprising feature of a smoked seafood cookbook that really a lot of the nice cook-with recipes are great for this time of year, the chilies, the chowders. Say the smoked haddock or fin and haddie lasagna, those are some of our favorites. And there's a lot of interesting variety in those, too, ranging from, say, the Moroccan-style North African harira with smoked haddock or smoked cod to a Thai bouillabaisse with smoked fish to just a chili or New England chowder with smoked fish. And all of these recipes can be done very nicely without smoked fish, which I think is an important feature of them, but this adding the smoked fish adds a certain kind of subtle nuance to them that can be surprisingly haunting and addictive at the same time.
Yeah, and you do have this section in the book, a primer on do-it-yourself smoking, which mm-hmm. looks sort of intimidating to me. I was thinking of it, but I thought, no, I don't think so.
Why would we do that when we can get this wonderful product from TR? Why should we try and reinvent his skill set? That somehow seems like
that's exactly the response we're aiming at.
you don't keep a dog and bark yourself, as they say.
Tiara, this has been such a pleasure. I mean, getting to know you, and you know, as I said, I'm attached to Ann Arbor anyhow, since
right.
I went to school there, and I can just see how this would fit into that wonderful academic ethnic mix in that town.
It is a wonderful town for this.
Yeah.
Absolutely, for exactly the reasons you mentioned, Ann.
Yes.
Absolutely.
So we help you make it through the winter. And
that I don't miss, the 12 inches of snow.
No, no.
I remember a friend of mine from Detroit said, Detroit is the grayest place in the world in winter. So a little bit of salmon sunshine
will do very
makes,
well.
Makes a difference. Thank you so much, Tia,
so.
For joining
you.
Us.
Thank you, and if you ever get to Ann Arbor, and I hope you will sometime soon, be sure to drop by the smokery.
I will. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks for...
And now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Please email us onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com or join our blog. That's
onthemenuradio.blogspot.com.
Exactly.
Exactly. Exactly. It's amazing. It's exactly correct. I say it every week, and I got it right once again. Isn't that amazing?
Right.
Now, who are we doing next?
Well, we're going to take a little zigzag from fish into gadgets, kitchen gadgets, which, of course, I mean, I don't know if you, these are so spectacular, these products. I don't know if you can call them gadgets because they're very serious tools for the kitchen.
First up is so glamorous that we decided that we'd use it as a centerpiece for a dinner party because it's a wonderfully designed product as well as an extremely effective one.
And award-winning.
And a representative of Microplane to talk about this award-winning gadget that every kitchen should have.
And then to stay
sort of on the same theme, a gentleman called Mr. Kramer, who has a way with knives that you just won't believe. Probably won't be able to believe it when you hear him, but you certainly wouldn't believe what he charges for his knives when you start out. So you're going to learn a lot about microplating and a lot about knives in the next segment.
Dana Butler, you have a very important job and a very important product. Your title is National Sales Manager of Microplane U.S. and Canada. Congratulations. You have a wonderful product to work with.
Thank you. It's been very exciting joining this team, and I've had a lot of fun so far.
Now, I don't know if there's anybody who's been living in a cave or under a stone who doesn't know about Microplane. When did the original RASP Microplane come out? It debuted as a kitchen equipment, and there's a little story about this, isn't it?
Yes, there is, and actually, just to mention, we're going on our 10-year anniversary for the kitchen division, so we're celebrating with a special RASP and a special color. But it really got started in Canada, where a housewife was making an orange Armenian cake. Needed some orange zest for it, didn't like the tool that she had in her kitchen drawer. For some reason remembered something that was out in her husband's tool chest, which was one of our woodworking tools, which was a RASP, went out, used that, and loved it, and called our office, I believe, and mentioned how much she liked it, said, we really should make kitchen products, and we at first just laughed it off and said, no way, we're into woodworking.
Yep. So it actually started out as the company started out making woodworking tools.
Right. Well, you could see it's a RASP.
Yeah, I can see it's a RASP. Yeah. I mean, I knew what a RASP was before you knew what a RASP was.
I hear that many times.
I'm sure I did.
I'm not sure about that.
but I wouldn't have thought of using a RASP on an orange. So there you go. It's something inventive.
That sounds like a title of novel.
No, I do know.
Don't use a RASP on an orange.
No, I do know how to use a hammer on a stove.
Yep. But that's another story.
That's another story altogether.
We have such an efficient kitchen, Dana. You wouldn't believe it with this stove. It goes on by you put a pot holder over this, an oven mitt. You put the hammer inside it, and then you beat it on the top. I mean, I'm not kidding.
I could probably take the hammer to it directly. The difficulty is it would chip the enamel. So it's not out of respect for the stove. It's out of not wanting to smash it into pieces, because it really is very frustrating, which a Microplane absolutely is not. I mean, the original tool, even a dummy like me can use it. But this new high-tech star-spangled version that arrived just a few days ago.
Well, now, give us the story.
How to describe this thing that we have that can rasp in 8 million different ways?
I don't know. I don't know how to describe it, but I know that Transition first came. You still make, by the way, woodworking tools, do you not?
Yes, we do. It's more limited. Our concentration is on kitchen. Okay. And we've also gone into personal care.
That's where you do pedicures.
Well, we do foot files for your feet.
Foot files, that one.
Yes.
Could I interchange any of these implements?
You know, that's how our personal care division was born, if somebody used a kitchen thing on
your
butt,
kidding.
So if you can come up with the next idea.
Oh, no, this is hysterical.
Pretty soon we'll be rasping wood with foot files.
Exactly.
Well, so anyhow, but you started out, I was rather amazed. I ran into your publicist at the last Fancy Food Show, Julia Stavoulis, and I couldn't believe she was at the booth. I couldn't believe the variety of these implements. I mean, I knew that you had different textures, fine coarse, and so forth for the basic RASP. But you have, how many different implements do you have for the kitchen?
Well, we're getting very close to 100, but you have to remember we have a lot of different colors and then different materials. So we'll have a plastic, we'll also have like a premium style handle with a black ergonomic easy grip handle. We have a whole stainless steel series. And then we also have the RASP, but then we also have almost like a flat paddle grater. So it's personal preference. But then in some series we have 6 blade styles, everything from fine, coarse, medium to small, large shavers and a spice grater. So those things cover anything from garlic, citrus zest, chocolate,
well, how
soft
many
cheese,
do you
hard
think
cheese.
The well-turned-out kitchen should have.
How many?
Mm-hmm.
I have found in my kitchen I definitely use 4. Because for me, knowing soft cheese, hard cheese, citrus zest, chocolate, garlic, those are basic things I use constantly. And with all the different cheeses and my husband's great love for cheese, I find that he likes different consistencies with different pasta dishes. And I find that a lot of our different graters allow you to have that.
Well, now you just sent me this amazing box grater. How many things does it? First of all, the design is fabulous. It has the ergonomic handle.
Yes.
And how many different functions incorporated into it?
The box grater has three different blade styles, so it has a very special extra coarse blade that we offer on none of our other graters. That is for soft cheese. It also has a medium ribbon that I recommend for garlic and chocolate. That's on the one side. On the back is our fine zesting blade. That's the one that you'll find on our super bestseller zester grater. That one is removable, so that allows you to either grate your cheese from the extra coarse and it not get stuck to the back, or you can pull it out, use it by itself, and it's just great for cleaning. And then on the last side, there is a slicing blade, which is good for carrots and zucchini and cucumbers and so on.
Oh, that's what that's for.
So that one is sort of like a mini mandolin?
Exactly. For just little jobs, maybe for preparing a salad. You also see that it comes with that great plastic cover because we know how sharp our blades are, and that's a permanent cover that you can use for storing it.
Yes, well, I mean, I was a little hesitant because they are, the blades are very sharp.
Yes.
So, no, you could, a person could actually just substitute this one tool for all these others?
I think it depends. I mean, I know for me there are certain things that I love to do with a box grater, specifically maybe large tasks, things for preparation. And then a lot of the handheld graters, they're great for passing around the table or maybe a quick job for two people. But I know when I want to do a casserole that includes two blocks of large cheddar cheese, I want to be using my box grater because that's something I'm going to do right onto a cutting board. But if I just want to have hard cheese for maybe a pasta dish for my husband and I, we would want to use our little rasp and just pass it back and forth.
That makes sense. Of course, if I'm going to do a whole bunch of shredded cheese, I'd use the Cuisinart, the food processor.
Right. Now, the only thing I'm puzzling over is this is, I guess it's such an elegant kitchen implement, you can just leave it out all the time because that's what we've done with it so far. The rasp is handy because the rasp goes into the drawer.
Exactly.
In your ideal kitchen, where do you store the box grater?
The box grater I have sitting out on my counter, and you're right, I have a special drawer for my graters, but of course I do because I work for MicroPlate.
But your box grater stays out all the time
because it's
too big to go in the drawer.
Yes, and I'm very proud of that, so I'm constantly bragging about it to anybody that comes over.
Yeah, well, I keep thinking I should show it off to people, so maybe I will leave it on the counter.
Yeah, we're having a dinner party on Sunday.
Maybe it as the centerpiece.
Yeah, maybe we'll make it a centerpiece.
I can put it in the center. The table with that Art Deco water that lights up.
I was thinking of putting it. We could put it right next to my champagne cutlass.
Yes. I didn't think of this.
Yeah,
it would be your centerpiece.
It's an accoutrement or whatever
yeah.
you like
oh,
to call it.
I think I'm going to do that because that's my color scheme, black and white.
So there must be some new products coming out, Dana. What's MicroPlane coming up with next?
Well, for right now, I just wanted to mention a couple other things that we came out with that are very new, one being an adjustable slicer, and I'm not sure what samples you have. So if you're already familiar with this, I can go into some other things, but I wanted to mention some new introductions that are only about 6 months old.
Please go ahead.
The adjustable slicer was born out of the idea that people were looking for just a great handheld slicer. Mandolins are great, but they're often large, have a lot of parts, require a lot of storage. We wanted to come up with something simple that would fit in your drawer, and it's a handheld slicer, $40 retail, fully adjustable from the side, goes from paper thin to about a quarter inch thick. So great for potatoes, slicing peppers, again, zucchini, cucumbers. It comes with a great food holder so that you can choose citrus and tomatoes. And the blade is ultra sharp, so you want to always use that food holder. And then it has special lip that it can fit right over the side of a bowl, and you can just slice right
into
there.
Oh, wow, that's pretty cool.
Yes. We also have a cut-resistant glove, one that I don't pair with the adjustable slicer because it's cut-resistant, not cut-proof.
Okay. Or
do you know how sharp
I did notice in your catalog about that because I was thinking I should have asked for one of those.
I love it. It really is a fabulous item. I've probably put mine in the washing machine 15 times.
Really?
It comes out perfect. It's one size fits all. You only need one because you'd be holding something with the other hand. Mm. And I do it all the time with MicroPlane products, but also when I'm making apple pie, I use a peeler, and it allows you to just be lazy.
Oh, great.
Anne needs one of those. She's a lazy slicer, too. She slices pieces of finger along with food all the time.
I'm not going to lie. I also use it when I'm weeding and I'm near a pricker bush in the summertime.
I know. That's a really neat idea. Well, I can't tell you how momentous I think this whole microplane development is. I don't know what we did before the microplane. I mean, it's revolutionized the kitchen implement utensil.
It really has. We've been so fortunate as a company, and we pull quotes every day, and our director of marketing, she really is good at finding all these things, and we laugh at how people use microplane as the terminology for grading. I mean, it's amazing how they'll say, well, I microplaned it. And we found all sorts of things. I think we even found a little blurb about somebody microplaning a street. And it was construction workers, and we laughed. We thought, well, there's a new meeting for us.
Well, now that you've entered the vocabulary as a verb, that is wonderful.
Yes.
Oh. Well, now, how about giving us your website, because you have all these wonderful things on your website.
Yes, it's www.microplane.com.
And do you have a store finder on it?
I do. Yes, we do.
Great. So people know when you do internet orders, but also retail outlets, right?
Yes, exactly.
That sounds good. And how much is this nifty thing that I have, this box grater?
That box grater is $34.95.
It's a bargain. It's beautiful.
Yes, it is. I mean, you think about the three blades, and the blades are all made in Russellville, Arkansas.
Oh, it's all made in the USA. That's great.
Well, the molding and assembly, no, but the blades, every blade that we have is made in Russellville. We're very proud
great.
Of that.
Why Russellville?
That is where the company, that's where our company is from, and that's where it's based.
Wow.
Great.
Okay.
Well, it's nice, it's wonderful to see that good old US of A can still do some things. They can make microplane blades, even if we don't know how to make cars for a price. So thank you so much, Dana, for joining us on the program.
Dana, it's been a delight.
And keep on microplaning.
Oh, good usage. Thank you.
Thanks,
okay.
Dana.
Okay, thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
On the Menu gets to meet so many interesting people, and we have one of them lined up for you to share in discussion with this morning, is Bob Kramer, who is a master bladesmith. Hello, Bob.
Hello, good morning.
Well, I didn't know there was such a title. I am certainly aware of your knives. They
it
are.
Actually sounds more like an Olympic event than
it
anything
does.
Else. Have you ever thought about that as a second career?
Well, no, actually I haven't.
But let's, first of all, tell us, you're out of Olympia, Washington, but you have a global customer base.
That's correct.
You're going to have to tell us. I mean, I could go on and on and on about this because I'm just so fascinated with your knives, your custom design knives. I've seen photos of them. They're so absolutely gorgeous, and you've backlogged on orders for 3 years. First, what were you before you were master bladesmith?
Well, I worked in a number of restaurants for 10 years, and I worked on the floor. I also worked in the kitchen. I mostly worked in the kitchen. That's where I started. And, you know, as a young man traveling around, I thought, well, I really probably should have a job that I can plug into different places because I want to travel. And so cooking seemed to be very attractive, and I figured I could always get a meal and have something to drink, and that seemed like a good strategy. So I worked the back of the house for quite a while.
Uh-huh.
And as I was traveling around, probably into maybe my eighth year of cooking, I worked at one of the Four Seasons in Seattle, and I realized then that I probably was not destined to become the executive chef or executive sous chef in a big corporate property. And I realized I was probably a little too hard-headed and stubborn to work for someone else. And so it began to evolve my fascination with knives and sharpness and what all of that meant.
Right. Now, how did you just research it and find out that there is a program for training knife makers, designers?
Actually, I started out sharpening knives. I noticed that even in this world-class kitchen where the executive chef had traveled all over and was Swiss, the executive sous chef was English, the garde-manger chef was Japanese, the only one of those guys and the rest of the top line cooks in the kitchen, of all of those people, maybe one, the Japanese guy, knew how to take care of his knives and actually sharpen them. And so there was some mystery surrounding the sharpening, and so I began to pursue that. And I thought, well, I'll start selling. I thought, you know, if I'm going to break away from the kitchen, I need a job. And so I thought, well, if I started selling cutlery to all my friends around the city of Seattle, I probably could make an okay living, and I'd still get to go in and out of restaurants. And so as I began to go from restaurant to restaurant selling knives, the response that I heard over and over was, I'd love to buy, you know, a Trident or a Forstner from you. Unfortunately, I can't afford it. Can you just sharpen this knife that I've had for a while? So I saw it as a way to supplement my income to learn this sharpening. And I thought, okay, well, I have to do this. And maybe I can pop the bubble on this mystery of what is sharp and how to get there efficiently and predictably every time, regardless of what kind of a tool someone would hand to me. So it started there.
Now, since the backlog for your work, are these new knives that takes you 3 years to make?
Yeah, and it's not so much that it takes me 3 years. It may take a day to make a chef's knife. So my production is quite low. I don't have a big factory. It's just myself. I've actually just recently hired an assistant in the shop and then an administrative person to handle the emails and paperwork and so forth. But that's relatively new. I've been working by myself, a little help from my father-in-law, which is he'll come in and help me grind some steel or just a number of projects around the shop. But by and large, I work by myself. So my production is a couple hundred knives a year.
Telling us about how he went from sharpening knives to making knives.
Yeah, well,
we skipped that stage.
No, I don't think we did. What I wanted to do next was to say, well, when you start to make a knife, I mean, you don't start with iron ore and trees.
Correct.
You start from some intermediate point. Are you actually buying or steel from somebody else?
Yes.
And can you let us into the secret of where the best steel comes from?
Well, best is one of those slippery topics. The best wine, the best car, the best stereo system. It's very subjective. So there are a number of places around the world that make excellent steel. And so then it comes back to your taste in steel, if you will. And the kind of steel I use comes from, actually, the manufacturer won't tell me. I believe it's made overseas, but I buy it through a U.S. distributor, and it's a bearing steel, the same kind of steel they make ball bearings out of, or roller bearings.
Okay, so you buy the steel as a chunk, or do you buy it sheet?
I buy it in plate.
Okay, so you're buying, and then you begin from that point, and so part of the skill is having figured out what steel is you think is the best, and then the rest is all about sharpening.
Well, no.
No,
there's a lot more to it. Design is a crucial factor. You can use excellent steel, but if you have a poor design, the knife will not be comfortable or will not be friendly to use. Heat treatment is a huge part of this. So you can have a very good piece of steel and even if you have a good design, have a lousy knife that is difficult to resharpen or won't hold an edge very well or chips out or breaks even.
It involves tempering and so forth.
Hardening and tempering.
Well, we use that in jewelry too.
Sure.
You know, I'm still going to persist this, Bob. I want an explanation of how you jump from being a itinerant knife sharpener to being a master bladesmith.
Yeah, well, it wasn't quite a jump. It was quite a journey. So once I began the pursuit of learning to sharpen efficiently, I started out with a tri-stone and thought that was my path. But when my pursuit was a commercial sharpener supplementing my sales of knives, and there's just no way to do it with a stone without, it's just too time consuming because people would hand me knives that really needed to be reshaped or thinned out. And it took me about 4 years to come up with an efficient way to really streamline the process and sharpen anything to shavable sharpness in about a 4 year period. And then I continued to sharpen knives commercially in the Seattle area I started in 86. 1992, I took my first bladesmithing class. So in that period of 6 years, my philosophy was that anything that came out of a commercial kitchen, I should be able to sharpen if it was a tool that actually took an edge. And so after about 6 years of doing it full-time, I began to kind of get bored or my fascination went deeper in that. People would ask, can I use this knife? You know, how many times can I sharpen the chef's knife? Can I turn it into a boning knife? If I sharpened it that many times, would it still be a good piece of steel? So there were questions like that I wanted to have an answer for. I felt like if I was the expert driving around from place to place, I should be able to answer any question. And I I came across a trade magazine on custom knives one time going through a grocery store, and so I got a copy and was just blown away by the quality of work and the fact that they were making folded steel and that they could, you know, make a knife from a file or a leaf spring on a car. And in the back of the magazine was an advertisement for a class in Arkansas with the American Bladesmith Society, a two-week course, and you would forge every day for 8 hours with a master bladesmith on a coal-fired forge. So I went to sign up for that, and the course was sold out that year. So I said, when's the next syllabus coming out, or when's the next schedule coming out? And they said, January. So I waited 6 months, and then January 4th, I called them up and bugged them and said, you know, I want to be on that list for next year, and then waited another 6 months till the class came around. So that was really my first entrance into custom knife making, and you know,
okay, and this is sponsored by the American
Bladesmith Society,
and that's a nationwide thing.
It's based in the U.S. Started in '76, but we have members worldwide.
Okay, and there's a website for this for people out there who want to learn how to make knives.
Yes, the ABS. If you look up ABS and bladesmithing or American Bladesmith Society, it'll get you there.
Okay, now, what makes your knives so wonderful? I mean, people clamor after them. Anybody who wants to go to your website, why don't you give us that, by the way, your website?
Sure. It's www.kramerknives.com, and that's K, Kramer with a K.
Right. I mean, people clamor for these. You have this backlog.
Yeah.
But you also do have an agreement with Shun.
Correct.
You and there, I've never understood the whole arrangement with Shun. I don't, that's one of the knives I've never seen, I mean, I've never had.
Uh-huh.
A Shun knife. But they have ads with all these different knife designers, right?
Correct.
So how many people do they have making knives for them?
Well, they have a number of designers. They Kershaw is rooted in the utility knife, hunting sport utility knife. And the culinary wing of their business is relatively new. I think it's about 5 years old. But they came on strong with some real innovative designs, and the fact that all of their culinary knives are made in Japan, or the bulk of them, is another reason that their knives have taken off, because the level of craftsmanship in Japan is quite high. And so I have a licensing agreement. I provide the designs for Shun, and they manufacture them in Japan.
Are okay. They still handmade? And
yes. There are a couple of operations where they're using high-tech machinery to facilitate certain operations. But I've been through the factory 3 times, and there's probably 100 or 120 people on the floor. And every single knife, particularly from my line, I think it has more handwork than any of the others. But there's about 150 craftsmen that handle each piece.
So it's possible to get a Kramer-inspired knife from Shun.
Correct.
If you don't have the patience to wait 3 years. Now, you have a rather special story, though, about one of the people who managed to jump on your wait list, even though you said, I'm too busy. The fiancé wanted to give his fiancé a knife instead of a ring.
Yeah. He wrote a beautiful letter describing his relationship with his fiancé and realized that it was time that he popped the question, and also knew that his gal was not someone who loved jewelry, but she loved to cook. And he had mentioned that they had read the review in Cook's Illustrated a couple of years ago, and she had mentioned to him that she really loved one of my knives. And so as he got closer to popping the question, he thought, well, what would be the most unique or special way that I could propose? And so in his letter, he asked if there was any way that he could possibly get on my list so that he could propose to this gal. And it was one of the most beautiful letters I've ever read, and I was flattered that he would use one of my knives as a vehicle to propose marriage to this gal. It was clear that he was crazy in love with her, and I thought, well, what a special treat for me to be a part of that. And so I had to think about it a long time. I just couldn't justify pushing everybody else on the list aside to take care of him. So I said, you know, the price on this is going to have to be dear to make sure that you're you're sincere in this endeavor, and that for me to be able to justify to the rest of the people on my list. And we came to an agreement, and so I worked hours that I wouldn't normally work to complete this knife, and I felt like that was another way that I wouldn't be insulting the other people on the list. So I worked in the evenings, and I worked on a weekend to complete this knife, and inscribed his proposal, engraved his proposal on the side of the blade.
Oh, that's a lovely story.
Isn't that wonderful? So then I think you said the fiancé wrote to you afterwards?
Yeah, they had an annual big family gathering on one of the relatives' property, and they're both artists, the relatives that host this party. So they're out in the country. The two people hosting it are artists, and it's a celebration of several anniversaries and a birthday that they all come together, and it was on the Friday evening that he actually gave her the knife after the party, and so afterwards she had written a beautiful letter about how everyone said, well, you need to wait because they were going to get married a year later. You have to wait before you use this knife and then cut your wedding cake. And she thought, well, that's a quaint idea, but there's no way I'm going to leave this knife in the box for a year. And she wrote back what pleasure she had using the knife and that it's going to be a wonderful heirloom to hand down to her kids.
Your knives are not just gorgeous. I mean, they are performance-driven, too. And what do you look for in a knife? You look for construction?
Yep, design is a huge part of it, and then the steel selection. When I started to build these knives, I had handled knives for 6 years, 7 years of sharpening knives every day. So I may sharpen somewhere between 100 and 300 knives a day for 6 years. And so I got to look at every single knife that passed through my hand and thought, this is a good feature, this is a bad feature, and when I finally began to build knives, I thought, well, I'm going to take all of that experience and try to put it into my piece. And so the design is the knife is very comfortable if you hold it in a pinch grip, or if you hold it by the handle, it's comfortable in both positions. And there's a number of knives out on the market that are comfortable in one but not the other. And my intention was to create a high-performance culinary knife. And for me, that meant ease of sharpening, retention of edge, comfort, and toughness. I thought this knife shouldn't be fragile. I shouldn't be afraid to cut certain things. And so those were the driving forces.
Well, I still think it's a fascinating idea that what you would do is you would put a sharp instrument in the hands of the one you love. And it seems to me that that's about as good a place as any.
Yep.
To say, Bob Kramer, thank you so much for joining us on the menu, and I'm sure Miss Anne would like a sharp knife, but I'm not sure I trust her all that much.
That's not very nice. Brings out the really brings out the truth about this. Yes, so love me, buy me a knife.
Yeah. Bob, thank you so
Bob,
much.
I just wish you continued success. I mean, your knives are truly works of art, and I'm just so impressed with how much you know about it.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
And how much you care about it.
It's my pleasure to share that information.
Okay, and let us know what happens.
Okay, will do.
Okay, Bob, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. And now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, welcome back once more to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Ann was sleeping for a moment there, so I just jumped right in there, and it turns out that...
Well, here we are again.
Yeah, it turns out that's appropriate, because the next interview is one that Peter did on his own, because I think Ann wasn't feeling well that day, and it's about a very important subject, which is the sustainability of the fisheries of the world's oceans, or the absence of sustainability that's there right now. So we have a spokesperson on this whole subject who's extremely knowledgeable, and someone you should listen to very carefully.
We have an interesting guest on program next. We don't have a lot of professional fishermen turned sustainable fishery advocates
on our program. I'm guessing that they're probably relatively small in number, but we found one. And his name is Phil Klein. He works for Greenpeace with a rather unusual job title, but his history goes back to commercial fishing. Phil, first of all, welcome to On the Menu, and tell us about your little journey through life.
Well, it's a pleasure to join you today. The more people that hear this, the more chance we have of turning things around in the ocean. I spent 29 years as a full-time commercial fisherman, captain, owner of small vessels in the North Pacific, fishing from the Bering Sea to Baja. My home port was in Northern California. I was a hook-and-line fisherman for salmon, tuna, rockfish, sablefish, some specialty fish for Asian markets, and I also fished 29 Dungeness crab seasons on the West Coast.
Now, hook and line fishing, if we stuck with hook and line, we'd be a whole lot more sustainable, wouldn't we?
If we stuck with hook and line, we probably wouldn't be having this conversation today. Lots of people ask me, well, what's your vision of sustainable fishing? And all you have to do is look to the past. There was a point, depending where you are in the world, not too long ago when we had not industrialized fisheries and there was hundreds of thousands of more fishermen than there are even today, but they were small boat fishermen fishing close to their home ports, supporting their local coastal communities. It's when we put the big nets out there of all different kinds and industrialized hook and line fishing, people running 40 miles of hooks for swordfish and stuff, that we started catching fish faster than they could replenish themselves.
Oh, okay, so there's a sort of a, there's even an industrialized version of hook and line.
There is.
But you didn't do that.
No, we were basically a hand baiting operation, or fished in fisheries that ran not that many hooks.
And if you did the kind of hook and line fishing that you were doing, then you wouldn't catch everything. You just catch a certain amount, but a lot would still go free and mature and do all that kind of good stuff.
Yes, if we just look to Eastern Canada and New England, at one point there were thousands of dories fishing for cod on the Grand Banks, on George's Banks, and everywhere in between. And that fishery went on for hundreds of years with gigantic volume. It wasn't until we put the factory trawler ships on those offshore areas that we virtually caught all of them in that region.
So you said, before we came on the air, you said rather elegantly that you decided to quit professional fishing because it was the law of diminishing returns you could see, and that was going to affect your livelihood. And in any case, all of a sudden you believed in something new.
You know, when we established in the United States our 200-mile limit and removed all the foreign fishing vessels back in the early 1970s, most everyone believed it was a limitless resource, that there would be no end. And at that time, we had limited marine science. We didn't even know the life histories of many of the fish we're catching. Come to find out that some of the rockfish species on the West Coast lived to be 200 years old. Some of the deep water species have very infrequent, successful spawning events. Well, we didn't even know that back then. So starting in the early 1970s when I started fishing, there was no meaningful limits. Virtually everyone was fishing wide open. And as the years rolled on, I started to notice that we were serially depleting one species after the next from the shallow water to the deeper water. And I could see the end was in sight, that if we didn't change our ways, we were going to catch them all. So I became a very serious advocate for changing those fishing practices to sustainable methods, areas, times, amounts, gears, etc. for about 10 years. So now we're up to the late 80s, early 90s. I could see that in some of the fish stocks on the West Coast that we had really seriously depleted them. So by the late 90s, after spending over a decade of being a sustainable fisheries advocate in my own self-interest as a commercial fisherman, wanting something to catch until I was too old to get on the boat, I knew it wasn't going to last, so I started looking for a job to work on fisheries policy to change our federal laws and get them implemented so that we would have a sustainable future. In 1999, I took a job working for American Oceans Campaign in Washington, D.C. to work on fisheries policy issues, specifically to help educate the world on the damage caused by trawling with big nets across the bottom of the ocean, particularly in sensitive deep-sea habitats of sponges and corals and things. 6 months after I moved to D.C. in 1999, the West Coast, that's Oregon, Washington, and California, which was my primary fishing grounds, the National Marine Fisheries actually declared those groundfish fisheries a disaster and for once limited how much people could catch in a way that actually would give those fish a chance to recover. However, the limits were so small it would be hard to justify risking your life by driving a boat around on the North Pacific to be on the verge of bankruptcy. So I actually felt pretty good about my decision to leave the commercial fishing industry and join the environmental community. And since that time, the laws in the United States fisheries have been totally changed from expand and exploit to conservation first, and we're in the process of implementing meaningful rebuilding plans, protecting sensitive habitats, and limiting the amount that can be caught. One of the most significant changes in U.S. fisheries policy was in January of 2007 when our overarching fisheries law was reauthorized at the behest of then-President Bush. It put the scientists in the driver's seat, and there is the mandate in the law that the managers of the fisheries regionally cannot exceed the harvest levels that are recommended to them by the scientific committee. And this is a huge change. It took the fish away from politicians that are dealing with short-term economics at the behest of big industrialized fishermen, and actually put the fish first. The future of American fisheries actually looks pretty bright as we get these fish rebuilt over the next few decades, depending on the species.
Now, let's put this down at the earthy level, which is where, it's one of the things that we were going to talk about, because in setting up the interview, Anne used the words, eating bluefin tuna is like eating a rhinoceros steak.
Oh, my goodness.
And because particular species, this is one that's really been truly decimated. Am I right?
The North Atlantic bluefin tuna, we don't know where the biological tipping point is, but there is truly a risk of extinction if brakes aren't put on that fishery, you know, virtually immediately. There's two spawning populations of bluefin tuna in the North Atlantic, one that spawns in the Gulf of Mexico and one that spawns in the Mediterranean Sea. There's intermixing of juvenile fish. The Mediterranean population is larger, but still more than 90% depleted than what it was only 20 to 30 years ago. The Gulf of Mexico spawning population is on a critical knife edge. Now the stock assessments, they're counting in individual fish, and the last one I saw was something less than 20,000 individual fish left.
Oh my goodness.
The increase in the value of bluefin tuna has been the driving force. Not that long ago, the bluefin off our east coast and off Canada, there was not much of a market for it, and some of it even went to be dog food. Now the Japanese and now the worldwide growing sushi market has just made the value of bluefin tuna unbelievable. For example, this year, one tuna that was actually caught off of Japan, and it was a little less than 300 pounds, sold in the Tokyo market for over $100,000.
And what's driving this then?
Well, this was driven by the status of a couple sushi bars, one in Hong Kong and one in Japan, that split this fish to say, we serve the world's most expensive, best quality fish. Fish of the same species, but from other fisheries, i.e. the Mediterranean, Canada, the U.S., sell anywhere from $10,000 to $30,000 a fish. But that's still an incredible amount of money for a fish when you're talking five to six digits.
But what's happened is that the Japanese have depleted their own waters, and therefore they're either fishing in or they're buying in other fisheries around the world. Isn't that what's going on?
I just read today a report that estimates that still 90% of all of the bluefin tuna in the world are either consumed by or then retraded by Japan. The North Atlantic stock is the ones that's in the most critically depleted shape. But there is also bluefin tuna in the southern oceans worldwide and in the North Pacific, both on the North America and Asian side. All populations of bluefin tuna are severely depleted. Now, to add insult to injury to this equation, because of the extreme value of these fish and because of the lack of large ones, in the last half a dozen years, tuna ranching has been developed where sane boats will go and catch schools of small tuna and then bring them back and put them in pens and feed them until they're big enough to sell into the Japanese market.
Oh, that's just so you. But when they do that, they don't spawn, so you don't lose any fish, but you don't gain any because they don't breed.
Right, you've eliminated all of those fish from the breeding population. Plus, particularly in the Mediterranean, the bluefin spawners, the big fish that are hundreds of pounds, their spawning areas are very well identified. And the fishing boats, because of the value of these big spawners, use airplanes to spot small groups of fish, as small as three or four fish swimming together, and then go and put a big net around and catch them. So we're getting them at both ends. We're catching all the spawners, and we're catching all the ones that had already been born but hadn't grown up big enough to be spawning stock yet.
Now, there are other fish that have been variously at different times considered to be severely depleted. I remember swordfish at one time, and we all swore that we wouldn't eat in restaurants serve swordfish, the good old, what's it called, the sea bass?
Striped bass?
Chilean sea bass, which is really another fish altogether. We found that and almost fished that out as well. What's happening with some of those other fishes?
Fish that...
I mean, what else is on the endangered list?
Well, sharks.
Okay.
Worldwide sharks are in really, really deep trouble, driven by the trade for their fins into China and other Asian markets, not even meat. Scientists estimate that more than 90% of all the world sharks have already been taken out of the ocean.
What about fish that would find its way more onto American dinner plates?
Atlantic halibut, critically low population. Chilean sea bass, which you've already mentioned, also known as Patagonian toothfish. A deep water fish from New Zealand, two of them actually, one called a hokie and one called an orange ruffy, are both being severely overfished. Their populations are severely depleted. Most of these fish that come from the extremely deep water live a very long time and have very few babies and really cannot take any kind of industrial exploitation, which is the kinds of volumes you need to actually make it profitable to fish on the high seas for fish that live deep in the water. Atlantic cod, Greenland halibut, most of the groupers are severely overfished, and you don't know what species of grouper or where it came from. In some areas, particularly tropical groupers, we've lost small populations already.
Now, is there a place where people can go to make sure that if they want to eat responsibly, they know what are good things to have and what are things to avoid? Does Greenpeace have a website, or does anybody else?
Well, Greenpeace doesn't have a website that promotes eating fish. There is information available from Monterey Bay Aquarium and Blue Ocean Institute that put out wallet cards specifically for consumers to be able to look at the fish that are in the green column, yellow ones to avoid, and red ones to never eat at all. There are some really delicious, good choices of really green fish, however. North Pacific halibut from Canada or Alaska, wild salmon from Canada and Alaska, most of the crab fisheries, most of the shellfish, oysters, clams, mussels. They're mostly farmed, but that type of fish farming where they're filter feeding actually enhance the estuary water. There's a lot of confusion over, well, it's farmed, it must be good. Well, for example, there's Atlantic farmed salmon virtually worldwide, and it is causing serious problems, both pollution in estuaries where they're raised, and it takes a lot of wild fish, sardines, anchovies, etc., that they grind up to make feed for these carnivorous fish in fish farms. So a better rule of thumb if you're looking at farmed fish is, does it eat vegetables or does it eat protein? If it's a carnivorous fish, it's probably being fed fish meal from wild fish that are ground up. Well, as we try to rebuild stocks of wild predators, be they tuna, salmon, or other things, they actually need to have dinner in the ocean for them still and not ground up and thrown into a fish farm pen somewhere. So farmed Atlantic salmon is also another one to avoid, and that's not to mention any of the health risk and omega-3 deficiencies and things like that.
Well, listen, Paul, Phil, we could talk all day here. I think what we've done is we've established a call for those. Well, on the menu listeners who care about this, to say, you know, this is an issue that we have to be concerned about, and if they want additional information, can they get in touch with you, or can they get in touch with the Greenpeace?
Yes, another really good source of information is to come to the Greenpeace website. It's www.greenpeace.org/seafood, and we have an entire section of the website set up and devoted to talk about sustainable seafood issues, fish at risk, and what people can do turn that around. Well, so again, it's greenpeace.org/seafood.
Well, listeners, I hope you'll listen to this and get involved and eat seafood responsibly, like Phil is suggesting. And Phil, thank you so much for coming to the program and telling us about this very, very important issue. And I hope, again, the world will pay attention to it.
Peter, it has been my pleasure, and feel free to call me anytime with questions or to carry on this conversation in more detail. Thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye, Phil.
Now, that was a marathon program, but I think packed with very interesting information that I'm sure you're all going to not only be interested in, but also probably act upon, especially sustaining fisheries, buying yourself new knives, and getting a microplane, and going to enjoy some fine Italian food and wine at Capitol Grill.
So, and get that smoked salmon.
Oh, yeah, and get some Trackelman smoked salmon while you're about it. So that's all for another week. We'll see you again, same time, same place, next week.
Bye-bye.